Okay, so in high school, I had a high school counselor. And one day, a few months before graduation, he called me into his office. I've been doing pretty well, you know, so I was kind of excited. I sat down. Mr. Counselor asked if I had any plans. I told him, you know, not really, nothing concrete yet, but I'd like to maybe, you know, continue my education, go on to college. Mr. Counselor shook his head, you know, kind of sadly. He said, well, for you, I'm not so sure that's really going to be in the cards. Really? Well, I do have an option that can put some money in your pocket right away. For real? He slid over a shiny brochure. It was for a toilet repair informational session. Now, you wouldn't be a plumber or anything. That involves a lot of learning that might fall outside your aptitude and abilities. But you would be working directly under a licensed and fully bonded plumber, and you'd gain some skills, and skills that are always going to be in demand. He smiled a great big high school counselor smile. So, what do you say? What do you say? What do you say? I wanted to say, did all the white kids get the same advice? But then, of course, we both knew the answer to that. I slid his brochure back over to him. I got up. I walked out. I closed his door. I did not slam it. I closed it. Like a regular person who had just had a meeting with his high school counselor. I saw my friend Julie Hayden, and she asked me what he said, and I was like, you know, we're just trying to narrow it down between Harvard and Yale. Great! Great! When I looked down at my hands, they were shaking, trembling, in rage. And I thought, he doesn't know me. He does not know me. He cannot know me. But in truth, I wondered if he did know me. Today on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present You Don't Know Me. Amazing stories from real people trying to explain themselves. My name is Glenn Washington. Tell everyone to either go away or make you a sandwich. Better still, tell them to go away and make you a sandwich. Because you're busy listening to Snap Judgment. Now, we're going to kick off today's show from the Snap Judgment live stage in front of an amazing Michigan audience. One of my favorite storytellers in all of the land, James Judd, is about to explain exactly who it is that he didn't know.
He is a winemaker, an adventure traveler. He is an artist in residence at the All For One Festival. But most of all, he is from New York City. And he's very insistent I say that, because if not from the Bay anymore, we're very sad to lose him, but you get to hear him today. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce Mr. James Judd.
Before I begin, I just want to take a moment to say how happy and grateful I am to finally be out here. I have been backstage wearing man Spanx for 2 hours, top and bottom, and it's killing me. I'm ready to begin. It was the first day of the last semester of the last year of law school, and 12 students have been chosen to participate in the New Hampshire Criminal Defense Attorney Training Program, and I am one of them. And on the first day of class, our supervising attorney says that tomorrow we are all going to meet at the Concord District Courthouse, where we are each going to be given our very own real live alleged criminal to represent on their first day of court. I know, it's huge. So the next day I show up at the courthouse, I've got my blue pinstripe suit on, I got my red tie, I got my shiny black shoes, I've got a briefcase filled with blank paper. And I walk into the courthouse and my supervising attorney is standing there and he hands me a case file the size of a phone book and he says, "You've got 5 minutes to get downstairs and interview your first client, and then you're going to represent her at her arraignment. Go," and he leaves. Now, I know that I should have read the things you're supposed to know on the first day of court handbook that they gave us, because as I'm racing down the stairs to meet my first client, I can't help but wonder, what exactly is an arraignment? I've got no idea, but you know what? I figure I've seen a lot of Law and Order, I'm gonna fake it. So I go downstairs and I meet my first client. Her name is Amy. Amy is an 18-year-old female. She's been accused of beating up her roommate, also an 18-year-old female. Well, even though I have no idea what I'm doing, I take one look at Amy and I think, it's gonna be fine. It's gonna be fine. It's gonna be fine. Because she's tiny. She is a teeny tiny little person. She can't weigh 90 pounds soaking wet. She doesn't look like she could hurt a fly. And she's adorable. She's got crazy purple hair and the raccoon eyes and all the piercings and the ripped up clothes and the green tights and the big black clunky shoes. She looks like one of Santa's elves. And the worst part is that they have her handcuffed. These handcuffs on this tiny little girl, and the handcuffs are chained to this metal bench that she's sitting on. And she's sitting there shaking and quivering like a little miniature greyhound. Okay. I don't know what I'm doing, but at least I can say something to her. I can say something lawyer-like, something that will instill confidence in her, in my ability to represent her, in what must be a very frightening situation for poor little Amy. So I say, "Hello, Amy. My name is James. And I want you to know that we here at the New Hampshire Public Defender's Office wish to do everything within our power to make sure that each and every customer is completely satisfied." Amy says, you, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you! I know what you are. You're just a stupid law student, and you're not even a real lawyer. And I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you! Holy cow, she doesn't need a lawyer, she needs an exorcist. Oh. And the worst part is now I can hear she's ripping that metal bench up off the floor. So I run to the door and I'm banging on it and waving to the bailiff through the little window. Get me out, I want to live, I want to live. The bailiff comes. He takes Amy and I up to an empty courtroom and we're seated at a big long table sort of right in the front row. And we sit and we wait, and then in comes the prosecutor. He looks mean, he's bigger than me, bald, purple suit, black shirt, green tie. I say, Amy, we're going up against the Riddler. The judge comes in, he looks really mean, and right away, the judge and the prosecutor start arguing back and forth about, I don't know. But whatever it is, it looks very exciting. There comes a moment when the courtroom goes silent, and I realize that all eyes are upon me. And the judge folds his arms and he says, I'm just wondering whether or not there might be somebody else here in the courtroom today who might like to add a few words on behalf of the young woman sitting over there in the defendant's chair. Oh, I don't know. How about you? And he points right to me. And he takes his little desk lamp and he spins around and he shines it right in my eyes. And I look into that light and I think, spotlight. I turn to my feet and say, Your Honor, I object to this travesty of justice. And just then, the bailiff puts something in front of me, and it takes my eyes a minute to adjust to what I'm looking at, and I realize that these are the pictures of the roommate that Amy is accused of beating up. And it's horrible. This woman is purple and bruised. I say, oh my God! Did you do this? What is wrong with you? You can't hit a person like that. It's wrong. Am I right? Am I right? It's wrong. Well, I stand back up. I say a few other things. The judge bangs his gavel. It's a mess. It's so humiliating. And the prosecutor is snickering. And the bailiff is snickering. And Amy is foaming at the mouth. The judge says, listen, I gotta tell you, your argument is absolutely horrible, but I do have to admit that you do have some stage presence. I said, oh my gosh, thanks. He bangs his gavel, he says, bail is denied. Bail. Well, the end of that story is Amy was remanded to the care of the New Hampshire penal system pending trial. But as the guards were wrapping those chains around her, we shared a little moment. Amy broke free from the guards and she ran toward me and she said, what she actually said was, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you! You come anywhere near me, I will eat you! But what I feel she was trying to say in that tiny, albeit, violent little mind of hers was, James, wait. James. James, wait. Tell me. Do we have a chance? And the bailiff led Amy kicking and screaming for the big steel door, her little black fingernails snapping off on the door frame. And I called out after her, and in my very best lawyer voice, I said, "Hang in there, Amy. I'm gonna be with you all the way through your trial and sentencing. Bye-bye." Thank you.
James Judd, from the Snap Judgment stage show, original score, written and performed by Alex Mandel, and the Snap Judgment players, David Brandt and Tim Frick. When Snap Judgment, the You Don't Know Me episode continues, someone likes mushrooms and not on cheeseburgers. And what if you were raised by your own child? All that and more when Snap Judgment continues. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the You Don't Know Me episode. Today, we're exploring the difficulties in getting across the real you for both admirers and detractors, who you are and why they can't understand. For our next story, for reasons that will become plain very soon, our subject is very hard to get to know. Please know that this story references illegal drugs, but don't worry. This is public radio. Snap Stephanie Fu speaks to Hamilton Morris.
The evening of January 31st, 1981, should have been a regular night for Stephen Pollock. He was a doctor and just had a long day of seeing patients in his San Antonio clinic. But he was late coming back for dinner, and his girlfriend, Mitzi, was worried.
She'd called his office multiple times. He'd never picked up the phone. So she brought the dinner that she'd cooked for them over to his office. When she got to the door, she found that it was locked. Pollock never locked his door, so immediately she knew something was wrong. And when she looked through the window, she could see the walls were splattered with blood and that Pollock had been shot.
Who killed Pollock? Nobody knew. And that there, the guy explaining Pollock's death, that's Hamilton Morris. He's a journalist, and he's the one who found Pollock's story in 2011, 30 years after it happened. And even though the case had long been cold,
I had to start investigating it because more than anything, I wanted to solve the murder.
The first compelling thing about Pollock's death was why it had gone unsolved for so long. And the second was Pollock's strange story. In the late 70s, he had been a renowned mycologist, a scientist who studies mushrooms. His focus was on psilocybin-containing mushrooms, or magic mushrooms.
And it seems like he was just a relatively straight-laced, hard-working scientist with a scientific interest in psychoactive drugs.
Of course, the terms straight-laced and psychoactive drugs don't usually go hand in hand.
For whatever reason, psychoactive mushrooms seem to attract very eccentric, obsessive, crazy people, prone to wacky and potentially unscientific theories, like that mushroom spores had traveled to Earth from outer space and that the mushroom was an alien life form sending a message to humanity.
But Dr. Pollock was committed to being the opposite of that. Sure, he had an enormous beard, glasses, tie-dye. He looked like a nerdy hippie, but his brain was all business. He wanted to be considered a serious scientist.
Pollock was very much committed to making a major impact on medicine. It sounds pretty weird now, but before LSD was illegal, it was used experimentally as a treatment for things like schizophrenia. And Pollock had read a lot of these publications and was interested in reviving the use of psilocybin-containing mushrooms as a treatment for psychological disorders. He genuinely believed that they could be FDA-approved treatments for things like autism.
So Dr. Pollock, he devoted his life to studying magic mushrooms. He wrote a study where he tested psilocybin on autistic children with remarkably good results. He traveled to South America to hunt mushrooms down, tried growing them on elephant dung. He discovered dozens of strains and four entirely new species of mushrooms, and he literally wrote the book on how to grow magic mushrooms, a book containing techniques that are still used today. He even developed a hallucinogenic mushroom called Psilocybe cubensis penis envy.
It's a variety that looks just like a penis. Yeah, it's probably about natural penis size.
But one of his truly important discoveries was Psilocybe tampinensis.
He found this one species. It was the first time it had ever been discovered in nature, and it's only been found a handful of times since. Some people will call it the rarest mushroom in the world.
Psilocybe tampinensis had a sort of truffle that grew in it called a sclerotia. This truffle contained psilocybin and was really potent. So potent, Pollock called it the philosopher's stone. He wrote, "It transports the consumer to states of transcendence and jubilation beyond the realm of ordinary psychedelics." Tampinensis was his ticket to mycological glory. It was so rare and unusual, so un-mushroom-like, that he thought he might actually get government approval to study it and market it as a medicine. But to do that, he needed to be able to do more research.
He wanted to build a $2 million mycological super lab, and if he had succeeded, it would have been the first of its kind in the U.S.
And this is the 1970s. $2 million was a lot of money he didn't have. But he was obsessed. Pollock's girlfriend at the time even said that he interrupted their lovemaking to go tend to his mushrooms. Now that's dedication. So he knew that no matter what, he was going to raise the money to achieve his dream of the super lab. Pollock was making a decent amount of money as a doctor, but he needed more. So he started to see more patients.
Apparently there were lines flowing out of the door of his office onto the street because he couldn't contain all of the people that were coming to him.
Because to fund his super lab, Dr. Pollock started to write scripts for anything. Quaaludes, Praludin, Dilaudid, opioids, all without real examinations.
And so he was dealing massive quantities of these substances to his customers, and he would just give them what they wanted and send them off as long as they paid in cash. And then on top of that, he was dealing illegal drugs as well. He was dealing cocaine, cannabis.
And this is patently, this is not really serious scientist stuff, right?
No, it doesn't look good. He is a very strong example of someone who is driven to insanity by their ambition.
Pollock's drug business got big, really big. He was sending out shipments of mushroom spores by mail, and
he was planting a massive field of cannabis plants a few miles outside San Antonio with the intention of harvesting it all and sending it across the country in Christmas cookie tins in December.
All the drug dealers in town knew who he was. And eventually, he caught the DEA's eye, too. They wanted him gone.
They had planes flying over the field, taking aerial photographs, and that they were going to bust him. They had discovered his crop. They were going to destroy it. At the same time, two undercover police officers had come into his office and received liberal prescriptions for Dexedrine without an adequate examination. And they were going to charge him for that as well. And it seemed as if his medical license was going to be revoked. Everything was sort of crumbling around him.
And then, as everything was building to a head, Pollock was shot and killed. Dr. Pollock's funeral was mushroom-themed. Magic mushrooms were handed out to mourners.
At Pollock's funeral, he was buried with a number of different rare psilocybin-containing fungus. And in his breast pocket, his associate had tucked a Psilocybe tampinensis sclerotium.
So right over his heart?
Yes.
The sclerotium, that extremely rare truffle, Pollock's baby. And that little truffle became that much more meaningful when, a few days later, the police broke into Pollock's lab and found 1,753 jars of mushrooms, the biggest shroom bust in America up to that point. The police seized all of them and set them on fire.
As far as the San Antonio Police Department knew, they had burned the very last specimens of this particular species. They had actually driven it into extinction.
It looked like the police were glad to be rid of the drugs and of Pollock's business.
When I spoke with a lot of the people who had investigated the murder during that period, they all described police who were completely delighted by Pollock's death.
Pollock's friends could conjure up some suspects, but the police didn't interview as many people as they would have liked. And when the police did find three very plausible suspects, they didn't bother charging them with any crime. Plus, strangely, Hamilton found out that all those charges Pollock had been up against, they'd mysteriously disappeared before Pollock died.
All of the charges were dropped just a few days before he was shot. That's also very strange, and there's no explanation for why that happened. The DEA has destroyed all of their records related to Pollock, except for the ones that are associated with this field of cannabis plants. Again, this is just a mystery. All I know is that Pollock was about to have his medical license revoked. He should have been brought to court for growing this field of cannabis plants, but the charges were dropped without explanation, and he was shot in the head.
So what did that mean? Did the police make a deal with Pollock that allowed them to drop the charges in exchange for information? And did someone exact revenge? Was it just a coincidence? Or was something more mysterious going on? Some people in the mushroom community thought that perhaps Pollock was fated to die.
People considered him as like a Prometheus figure.
Prometheus, the Greek god who gave humans the gift of fire. In the myth, Zeus was outraged.
Prometheus!
Because fire was supposed to be something so powerful, it was meant only for the gods. So he punished Prometheus for eternity. These mushroom aficionados were comparing Prometheus to Pollock.
He wrote these books that were some of the most valuable manuals for cultivation of psilocybin-containing mushrooms that had ever been published. And they felt that he had been punished for bringing this knowledge to mankind, that he was the one who took the risk to make this information available and he paid the price. It absolutely feels unjust.
So Hamilton set out to do better than the police. He conducted over 100 interviews over the span of a year with everyone Pollock knew. He traveled to San Antonio, and that's when he really learned that Pollock was a really unpopular guy. Not just to the cops, to everyone.
I mean, the sheer number of people that were actually, that openly talked about plotting to kill him is ridiculous. There were people who came forward saying that, yes, I was actually plotting to kill him, but I never got around to it. Someone else killed him first. It seems as if almost every drug addict in San Antonio was aware of him and had some plot either to rob him, to kill him, who knows.
Hamilton found out that Pollock had been selling drugs to addicts, to pimps who would drag in their prostitutes asking for prescriptions for them.
Sometimes the prostitutes were actually unconscious, but Pollock would still write them prescriptions.
Lots of people had terrible things to say about him. One of his colleagues said he believed Pollock had never administered psilocybin to autistic children. He said Pollock just made up those studies so he could look more legit.
There's two different versions of Pollock, and this is what makes him complicated. On one hand, you have the interpretation that he genuinely believed that these drugs had potential. And then, you know, there's another version of him that makes him seem like a kind of weird, womanizing drug addict who had no moral scruples.
And hearing this, it kind of seems like maybe who killed Pollock is not as important as why he died. His death did seem inevitable, in a way. Maybe it was because Pollock was bringing a wonder drug to humanity. Or maybe there was just something about Pollock that made people hate him. But even with everything he learned, Hamilton doesn't dislike Pollock.
You know, I don't think that his behavior was inherently bad. I understood where Pollock was coming from and thought that his mission was a valid one. I think that there is an immensely important task in hunting for mushrooms, finding new species, looking for new therapeutic alkaloids in these species. The truth of the matter was that he was a doctor who was trying to develop medicines to help people.
But sure, but like, he was prescribing pills to unconscious women. Like, but it really seems that you believe that he was a good guy.
I believe that he was a good guy, and also I think that the main aspects of his personality that stood out to me were the monomania, the dedication, and the obsession with finding new mushrooms is something that I really value. I think that's a great character.
Eventually, Hamilton reached his last deadline. He'd been trying to write a piece about this for Harper's Magazine for a year, and they didn't want to wait any longer. So he packed up, closed the investigation, and went home. The article came out in the July 2013 issue of Harper's Magazine.
I still want to solve it. I still hope that, you know, after it's able to be read by a few more people, that someone will come out of the woodwork, that some new evidence will emerge that will allow some sort of definitive answer to what happened. That's the fantasy, but I think that it's just going to be too difficult.
But even though Pollock is gone, his ideas didn't die with him. That's become more and more evident in the past few years. One of Pollock's associates went to Amsterdam in 2008, and he was shocked to see that Psilocybe tampanensis, the rare truffle that was Pollock's baby, it was being sold everywhere.
He had no idea that it had survived, that anyone had kept the culture, and he had no idea that it had become this massive million-dollar industry.
All because of Pollock's research.
Yes, all because of Pollock's research.
Apparently, one of Pollock's spores had survived. It had been sent to a spore library in the Netherlands, where it sat until it was discovered a few years ago, and then cultivated.
And they call it the Pollock strain. With people all over the world going to Amsterdam, going to smart shops, getting these little Tupperware containers full of this fungus. They don't really know what it is other than it's a legal source of psilocybin, and Pollock's name will be right on the packaging.
And it turns out now that whether Pollock was a demigod or a very flawed man, his ideas may have been right. In the past couple of years, scientists at Johns Hopkins, UCLA, NYU, and other universities have been doing studies on psilocybin, and they found that it could actually be extremely beneficial for people suffering from mental illness.
It could treat PTSD, or that it could treat OCD. I mean, this was not some kind of weird, druggy, hallucinatory vision, some kind of justification for hedonistic drug use. I think that he truly did understand something about psilocybin that was correct, that it does have immense therapeutic potential.
Sure, magic mushrooms may not be Prometheus's fire, but they may be something big.
The test of time has shown that he was right, that psilocybin has enormous power, and all of the current scientific research points towards conclusions that are very much aligned with what Pollock thought all along.
Magic mushrooms, magic mushrooms, magic mushrooms. Making me insane. Oh, look out, here comes Elvis, wearing suspenders and a pink dress.
Big thanks to Hamilton Morris
for sharing his obsession with the Snap. Big thanks as well to Harper's Magazine. That piece was produced by Stephanie Fu.
Hey, can I ask you guys a question? What's something that people think about you that totally isn't true?
I'm stingy, but it's totally not true.
Oh, people think I'm spoiled and rich, but I'm not. Like, people usually think I'm like a spoiled white girl, but I'm not.
People think about me, they think I'm a pimp, and it's not true. I am a hard-working man. I am a shoeshine man. I own a shoeshine parlor at Frank Agawa Plaza right here.
Difficult to believe that I'm a mean guy. I'm inside of my head a lot, and the things that I'm thinking about, it reflects in my facial expression, which is probably a frown or a mean look, because I think about the war and the things that I did sometimes and the innocent people that I hurt, and I have not been able to reconcile that inside of me.
People mistake me for somebody all the time. I get mistaken for all dwarf actors that are on the movie screen. Bridget the Midget.
Well, I got dreads, you know. I'll be walking down the street, right, and I can see a lady, and she'll clench her purse if I walk past her or something. And I'm just trying to get home just like her, you feel me? It'd be hella judgmental out here on these streets.
Snap Judgment, the You Don't Know Me episode continues after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the You Don't Know Me episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today on the show, we're exploring situations where things are not quite as they seem. You know, a lot of us, we think that we have this parenting thing down. We have the mothers, the grandmothers, the books, the education, the videos, and we think we can give advice to other people on how to do their thing. Well, our next guest, she describes how she was forced into an unorthodox parenting style, not of her own choosing. Producers Hannah Baba and Snap Judgment Stephanie Fu have the story.
Samina Ali's doctors reassured her all through her pregnancy that everything was just fine. But she had headaches throughout the pregnancy and suspected something was off.
My son was delivered, and 20 minutes after he was delivered, I had a seizure and then I went into a coma. They wheeled me to get an MRI of my head. And they found that I had 2 brain hemorrhages. The next few days, my liver stopped functioning, my kidneys stopped functioning, I had pulmonary edema. I mean, I had multiple organ failure. And the doctors told my family and my husband at the time, if you're lucky, she'll just die. My son's father was told to be prepared because he was not bringing home the woman that he brought to the hospital. I had severe aphasia, which means that if I'm thinking one word, a different word would come out. So I was having difficulty speaking. I was having difficulty walking.
Incredibly, she couldn't even remember her husband.
I remember I kept looking at him and thinking, okay, you're my husband. Okay, I'm told that we got married. Okay, I'm told that my son is your son. And I just remember looking at him constantly and thinking, I guess this means I should feel something for you, and I guess this means I'm in love with you. But he was a stranger to me. I came back almost, I came back like my son.
Samina's son was named Ishmael, and when he was a toddler, she found herself bonding with him not as a son, but as a peer.
I would say, okay, today my goal is to get up from bed, walk to the bedroom door. I mean, there are definitely times when I would fall on the ground right smack next to him, and we would be on the ground together. And, you know, and there are times when I was on the floor crawling because I just didn't have it in me to take another step. I was watching him do the same thing, learning to walk, learning to crawl. Sometimes more, he had more functions than I did at times. We were out, and every time he would pick up a leaf or stop and admire bark on a tree, I remember being stopped in my tracks. He would have his fingers on the grooves of the bark, and I would have my fingers on the grooves right next to him. I was seeing nature, and I was seeing this bark for the first time, just like he was. And he would say, "Mama, this is so beautiful." And I would say, "Yeah, it is really beautiful, isn't it?" I was his buddy, and I was growing with him.
Just a few months into Samina's recovery, her husband also suffered from a debilitating brain lesion. This meant that both of Ishmael's parents were sort of out of commission as parents. They were both so focused on their own recovery that they didn't really discipline him at a young age.
I allowed him to make his own decisions even when he was 2 years old or 3 years old. "Oh, you don't want to go to bed yet? That's fine. We don't need to go to bed yet. You can stay up." Or, "You don't want to eat that? That's fine. I understand." You know, whatever. If he didn't want to go to school that day, "Oh, okay. That's your decision. That's fine."
Wow.
Yeah. I was his friend.
But being a friend can be harder than being a son, because we depend on our friends. Friends have responsibilities, especially when things go badly, like when Samina and her husband began to fight.
There was just a lot of tension in the house. There was a lot of sickness in the house. His father and I were fighting so much that he would physically push his dad out the door and say, "Go to work, Daddy, go to work, enough, enough, enough." And then when I moved out, I kind of moved out overnight. And so over the next week or so, I would have to return to the house to pick up more and more things. And he would say, "I'm just going to sit in the car while you go in." And he was only three.
After Samina and her husband both recovered from their brain injuries, they divorced. Ishmael split his time between his mother and his father's houses. And Ishmael's father began to finally lay down the law.
His dad is definitely the one who puts limits and boundaries. You know, not being able to watch TV, not having video games. "Did you practice your saxophone today?"
But Samina, she found she still couldn't do that.
"My God, his dad and I have fought about this. I mean, this is where we get into constant arguments. His dad isn't respecting Isham in the way that I feel like he should, because I don't believe that Isham needs the kind of strict limits that his dad places on him. So I allow him to govern his life because I respect the decisions he makes."
Ishmael was always his mother's confidant. When he was eight, Samina made sure she had his permission before she married her new husband. She got his permission before choosing a house, a custody arrangement. Ishmael's 13 now, and he knows his relationship with his mother is special, that he had a lot more power growing up than his friends did. And perhaps because he always had such an impact on his mother's life, in some ways, Ishmael began to feel responsible for her.
He has a very strong and unusual sense of protection. You know, like we were visiting my mother over the summer. And, you know, as mothers and daughters will do, we would have arguments. And Isham, he just became so upset. And he just immediately started telling his grandma, you know, "This is my mother and no one talks to my mother this way. And she's doing the best she can. And maybe he is overly protective of me."
Like, he's protecting you from your own mom. Mm-hmm. That's huge.
Yeah.
Like, you know, grandma's grandma.
Yes.
Samina's family and friends always worried that Ishmael would turn out to be this wild child because of the freedom she gave him, still gives him. But Ishmael's constantly on the honor roll now. He's mature, polite, sweet.
And does he ever talk back?
No.
And never?
No.
Never yelled?
No, my God, no. He would never yell.
Never raised his voice in any way, I want this, or I don't want that, or what's going on, or nothing, none of that?
No,
teenager-y
no.
Stuff.
I mean, I think that, you know, his dad has talked about, oh my gosh, you know, Isham is showing me all this attitude recently. He's definitely a teenager. And
you don't see any of
that? And I don't see it. You know, my husband says it all the time. He says, you know, Isham is a different child when he's with you, and he's a different child when he's with his dad, and you have to just accept that.
But this doesn't mean that Samina thinks everyone should parent their children this way to avoid teenage meltdowns. On the contrary, actually. Because 4 years ago, Samina had a child with her new husband, and...
Oh my God, I'm screaming, I'm yelling, I'm putting my foot down. You know, I'm telling her it's time for bed, it's this, it's that. I mean, I'm constantly setting limits. I'm constantly curbing her and, you know, helping her and guiding her.
Overdoing it maybe to compensate?
Maybe. When I'm disciplining her or when I lose my temper with her, he is taken aback. You know, because he hasn't seen that side of me.
But Ishmael? He still sleeps when he wants to, studies when he wants to at his mother's house. Samina believes that relationship will never change.
I look at him and that sense of kinship is still so strong and I still see it. It's so impossible for me to separate him out from me. And he has become what I think I've asked of him.
Much love to Samina Ali and her entire family. That piece was produced by Hannah Baba and Stephanie Fu. About that time. About that time, but not to worry, snappers, not to fear. Full Snap Judgment episodes, podcasts, movies, pictures, stuff available right now at snapjudgment.org. Facebook the Snap, or Twitter handle, snapjudgment.org. Feed Snap to your tiny babies, not too much, not too much. You can even mix a dab of Snap with your toothpaste and watch the world smile back at you all day long. Snap was produced by myself and an entire crew that swears they know nothing, nothing about anything called a magic mushroom. Please suspend disbelief for the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Mesiti Miller likes to pour liquids over ice. Stephanie Fu's real name is Thurston McGillicuddy. Anna Sussman refuses to swim in a swimsuit. Julie DeWitt shoots apples off people's heads. Nick Vanderkolk pours apple juice on people's heads. Renzo Gorio challenges people to duels. And Will Urbina can throw and catch a spinning baton. Now, did you ever see that person learning to juggle past the age when it's okay to learn to juggle? Don't worry. It's just the Corporation for Public Broadcasting trying to keep it real at the park. Just snatch those beanbags away. Give them a stern look. Much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Exchange is more than just public radios, if you know what I mean. Do you know what I mean?
I'm not quite sure what I mean. PRX.org. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could be born into a musical family. You could play violin before you're 5, master the piano by 10, sing in Carnegie Hall before the age of 13, only to discover that you were accidentally switched at birth, and your birth parents are now insisting that you learn accounting. All that, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.